Hey y'all, welcome back to Bowls with the Bard. My name is Cakes. I am your host. And today we are here with someone I have been itching to have on the podcast since we were a little baby YouTube show. We have Charlene B. Smith. Charlene, would you like to tell the folks at home a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I am a director, actor, scholar, and feminist arts leader. I'm currently located in Cleveland, Ohio, but I spent about 15 years previously in the Washington, D.C. area, where I co-founded and ran Brave Spirits Theater, a feminist Shakespeare company, which is how Cakes and I met and know each other. And outside of the theater world, I just will try almost any hobby. So I like crochet and embroidery and journaling, and I am starting to get into board games right now.
Ooh, hell yeah. What's your
Yeah.
most recent board game?
Like the one I most recently purchased,
Yes.
I just picked up secondhand a copy of Mage Knight, the Ultimate Edition. And so it's like
Ooh.
the box is enormous.
Oh, wow. Okay. We've got a couple of those in our home as well. They're like 20-pound boxes.
Oh, okay. Now I'm gonna have to visit and we're gonna have to play board games.
For sure, for sure. Well, we have Charlene with us here today to talk about the amazing Margaret.
Woo!
We've actually already had our conversation in which we smoked and drank and got prepped for this show. So we will dive right into the interview. Charlene, before we get talking about your thoughts and opinions about Margaret,
I have so
can you?
many.
Oh, I know. I'm so excited. Having you on to talk about Margaret is the dream.
Oh.
It truly is. So before we start talking about her, could you give audiences at home who might not know who she is in the canon a little bit of insight?
Yeah, and this is my attempt to be brief, and it's not even that concise. But anyway, Margaret of Anjou is a historical figure from the Wars of the Roses. So 1400s is what we're talking about. She was a member of the broader French royal family, and she ended up marrying England's King Henry VI in an attempt to bring peace between England and France during the Hundred Years' War. And Henry was not an effective king for this turbulent time period, and this was exacerbated by the fact that he had a debilitating mental illness. Which some modern scholars have argued was a form of schizophrenia. And due to his health issues, Margaret, took on a leadership role in England. And this move, I think, when you look at the historical record, was sort of very natural when you look at the way women in her family sort of wielded power in France. But of course, the English nobles were not a fan of this as an option. And this and many other factors led to the Wars of the Roses, in which the House of York, which was one part of England's royal family, made claim to the crown. And so, anyway, Shakespeare took all of this history and dramatized it into four plays: Henry VI Part One, Henry VI Part Two, Henry VI Part Three, and Richard III. And Margaret is a fills an incredible role within Shakespeare's canon because she goes on this incredible arc. Even if you just look at like number of years perspective, because historically she's like a teenager in one Henry VI, and then all the way to a senior woman in Richard III, and so that historical time period she was ages 15 to 52, and then if you count the four plays together as one, she's the largest female character that Shakespeare ever wrote.
So incredible. So I
Yeah.
know you are like her biggest stan, at least the biggest one I know of. And I'm interested to know like what initially drew you to this character.
Oh gosh. So I've been on this path for so long that I was like trying to like piece together when it started, and it was a little difficult because it just kind of feels like at this point it's always been a part of me. So I saw the RSC's history cycle in 2008, But I know I was already Team Margaret before that, and like a lover of the history place in general, which is, you know, like why I flew across the ocean to see that cycle. So I think it had to have started when a couple years after undergrad, I just undertook a project to read through the entire canon play by play, and kind of like I blogged about what I was reading. And I think that's sort of when I first read through all, because I think a couple of some of the history plays I hadn't read at that point, and that really gave me that appreciation for those plays and her as a character. I think the reason I was initially drawn to her probably had to do with how relatively few female characters there are in Shakespeare's plays, even to begin with. You know, and most of the characters that are women, they don't get to talk very much and they don't get to do very much. But Margaret gets to fall in love, she gets to kill her enemy. She gets to lead troops into battle and curse a lot of people and mourn her family. And just like all these wonderful scenes that are a gift for an actor, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So from there, what do you feel has kept you around?
Oh gosh. I think that I can't let go of her for kind of three reasons. One is I'm just fascinated by the real woman. You know, the actual Margaret of Anjou, what she had to go through, and how much we don't know and have to guess about her motivations and her feelings, right? And then I'm fascinated by Shakespeare's version of her, especially because he keeps her around for Richard III, even though the historical woman was sent back to France and died 3 years before the Battle of Bosworth. Huh. So, you know, she wasn't even alive for a good number of the events in that play, and yet Shakespeare keeps her there in England to be that reminder of all that has come before. And then lastly, I'm fascinated by the way we respond to her. So, right, she is this figure of endless reinvention, and even you could argue of projection. Like, people see in her what they want to see in her. And this goes all the way back to her own lifetime and how she was treated in the English History Chronicles, and the way she was sort of seen as this evil counselor and blamed for, you know, the fall of the House of Lancaster and all the wars that were going on. She was a convenient scapegoat. And then you look at today in the modern theater, and I feel like there's as many versions of her as there are performances, in part because the Henry VI plays are so subject to conflation and adaptation, that she keeps being reinvented through performance.
Huh. Yeah, that's fascinating. I definitely feel like I've seen several very different depictions of her on stage. So yeah, you mentioned that Shakespeare keeps her in four plays. Like, why do you think he does that? He doesn't do that with any other female character. Or any
yeah.
other character, period?
There are, so Henry's, the Fifth brothers, John and Humphrey, appear in four plays, but I think that's it. And they're sort of their own category too, because they span the two tetralogies in the four plays they are in. But I think it's just the three of them that hit four. We know we have Falstaff in three plays, and a few other of the history characters make it to three plays, but if I recall correctly, they're the three that are in four separate plays. And of course, it's interesting because, like, in modern theater, that seems like such great arcs. And of course, Henry V is a three play character as well. But we may be reading back modern sensibility into early modern practice, because we certainly can't say that when Shakespeare originally wrote these roles, that the same actor would have kept in the same character. It's so hard to know, like, what Shakespeare was interested in at the end of the day, right? Because all we have are his artistic works, and artistic works are always seen through a lens of interpretation, and they are works of fiction. I mean that from even just like whatever a creator or author may think or feel, that in some ways is fictionalized in the creation of a work of art. I mean, yeah, I don't know how to wager a guess. I mean, some scholars will argue that he had this really great boy actor that he was training up, and, you know, especially when you look at the way female roles advanced over his plays leading up to like Cleopatra, that it could have had to do with the casting. Some of it is, there does seem to be a little bit of perhaps a friendly competition back and forth between Marlowe and Shakespeare in these early plays. And they have these female characters that have a lot in common. And I don't remember the exact chronology, but you look at Edward II and Isabella of France in that character, in that play, she's a lot in common with Margaret. And so there's some responding to the zeitgeist that is like the London theater scene. But it's also interesting because like there were other plays in the period that dealt with this same time in England's history that do not make Margaret a character at all.
Huh.
Right? So she is not in any of the other versions of Richard III. And she's not in the other, you know, Thomas Hayward's two-part Edward IV play. Huh. Right? She's not a character in that. And even if you go up to, I think there's some plays up into the 1600s that kind of do stuff that, like, again, there's a couple plays, and I won't remember them all correctly, where like Henry VI shows up as a character, but there is no Margaret. So at the same time, I don't want to be like, well, it's obvious to put Margaret in the stories of the Wars of the Roses, but also like other playwrights didn't, you know?
Huh. That is fascinating. It's like clearly there was something there, but we'll never get to know. Of these four plays, like, do you have a favorite for Margaret? And like, why is it your favorite if you do?
Well, I have opinion on all four of these plays. So I will say, I just have to hit my drum to say that One Henry VI is a vastly underrated play, and it is so great in the theater and so exciting to work on. And I don't know why people think it's a bad play, because I found it when I worked on it to be so directable and so actable, and like just like actors really having fun in the room. She only has one scene in that play, so we'll leave that aside. Now, Two Henry VI, dramaturgically, I think is the worst play of the four. Its structure is very difficult to figure out. And I think it's the hardest to follow, just for like a layperson or a, you know, an audience member that has no context. But it has the single best scene, not just for Margaret, but in all of Shakespeare. And that is when Margaret and the Duke of Suffolk have to say goodbye to each other. And this is so fascinating, because even if you ascribe to the argument that Shakespeare was writing Margaret as a villain and as sort of this sexist idea of a woman messing things up, she still has this scene that makes you feel what she's feeling. And I think it's the most beautiful love scene that Shakespeare ever wrote, when they have to say goodbye to each other. And so then I think from a Margaret standpoint, Three Henry VI is the best play. She just gets to do amazing things in that play. And that play starts, boom, right out of the gate. Mm-hmm. Like, there is no time to ramp up. We are on high octane from scene one in that play. And when you revisit it, you sort of, it can be easy to forget just like how much happens. And then you like open it up and you're like, oh my gosh, you know, like we take down York and we get the crown back, and then we lose the crown. And then, oh, here comes Richard III. And he has a lot to say. And then through the climax where they find the Lancaster finally lose and Margaret gets captured and she has to watch her son murdered in front of her, and then the very next scene is Richard murdering Henry VI. Like, that's such a gut punch, those things together. So I just think Three Henry VI is a terrific play. And the thing I want to say about Richard III, which will not surprise you at all, is that people need to stop cutting her out of Richard III.
Oh my God, yes.
It totally unbalances the play, but she's so frequently removed as a character because of her relationship to the previous plays, which often audiences, particularly American audiences, don't have context for.
No, but that's such a bummer. I just saw it like a couple days ago, Richard III, and like, as I watched that particular production, I felt myself being like, and there's another one of her prophecies, and there's another one, and there's another one. Like, it's gotta be in there. Like, she tells you everything that's gonna happen.
And the power Shakespeare gives not only her, but all the women of the play, which is amplified when they're all present. Because, like, none of the men in that play are able to stand up to Richard, but the women do. Right? And I think that's a very important aspect of the play. But I think it often gets lost, sight of it gets lost, because I think a lot of productions are interested in Richard III as a character in Richard III only, and other characters in that play can kind of get left behind. So quite literally, like Margaret, who just gets cut out of the script.
Yes. Well, speaking of like cutting her and losing Margaret, like, we don't get a lot of these Henry VI plays, and I'm interested in knowing what you think we lose in not seeing them, and therefore not seeing as much of Margaret as we could.
Well, there's sort of like the like general philosophical and like economic answer, which is, of course, that like women make up 51% of the global population, but only 16% of Shakespeare's characters are female. And this is something that stuck with me. There was a like an infographic in The Guardian, like maybe even a decade ago, by like Elizabeth Freestone and a couple other people put together. And I've like never forgotten it, because it had that number. And then it also had a graph that showed that like in Hamlet, the play Hamlet, you know, one of the most produced plays, if that as written, women only speak 9% of the lines. And like, I'm sure there are people who'll be like, well, who cares? But when you look at the fact that studies have shown that women are perceived as speaking too much in a conversation, when they hit, it's something like 20% of the conversation, 25%, they are perceived as like being overbearing and speaking too much. And you go, well, how does a society build such an expectation for female silence? And you go, well, our most performed playwright has women speak 9% of the time. Like, that is not an accurate reflection of the world. So I'm always for shows where the women get to speak more, and there's more speaking. And certainly some of these early history plays, there is a more even balance among characters. And I think that, like, again, when you're an actor, an actress working in Shakespeare, there are still so few roles for you, relatively speaking, right? And you just think about what a male Shakespeare actor, how his career can progress, right? From like Romeo and Orlando, and then he moves up to Benedict, and then, you know, and then he's playing Mark Antony, and then event and Hamlet, and then one day he makes it up to Lear, and our track is, and in between all of that, he has all these supporting roles to play that help him develop those chops. And we don't have anything near the longevity, you know, the sort of closest, I think, like Cleopatra in terms of women is sort of what the most dynamic and the closest to like a Lear that women have. And then maybe also Margaret, but you need all four plays for that to be there. And I think that she does surprising things that you don't find a lot of, right? Which some of which I mentioned before, that she gets to straight up murder, like stabby stabby her enemy, when again, even in either other women who participate in murder in Shakespeare and in other early modern plays, usually they poison it is their weapon of choice. Like, it's a very gendered thing. But Margaret gets to stab the Duke of York, you know, with a knife or a sword in the middle of a battlefield. Right. And I also, in 3 Henry 6, I love the speech that she gives to the troops, you know, to energize them to fight, because that's something we don't see women do a lot in media and popular culture. The idea that a woman can be a general and move the troops to fight.
Wow.
She gets, it's like her own Crispin's Day, you know?
No, and we really don't. I can't think of something even close to something like the only thing that comes to mind is like actually the opposite, which is like, oh yeah, for God's sake, go not to these wars.
Yes, yes.
Like, you
That's
don't.
true. A lot of times women are pleading with men not to fight, you
Yes.
know?
Yeah.
So, and even like the closest you could talk about Joan of Arc, who leads troops and is victorious in battle, but she does not have like a battle speech in the same way that Margaret does. I mean, she has her great soliloquy kind of near the end of her arc where the spirits desert her, which perhaps if it went a different way, perhaps if Joan of Arc's story had a happy ending, that would have become a battle speech. But yeah, it's great stuff, you know.
Yeah, for sure. And now you are on this epic mission to find Margaret in places that are not Shakespeare. Do you want to tell us like a little bit about that and tell us about like what favorites have been?
So this started with when I was writing my Emlet thesis a decade ago at this point, on Margaret on the modern stage, and starting out kind of talking about how she finally sort of got to be performed as a character, and kind of arguing that like she was Shakespeare's first and last heroine because she was in like the earliest plays he wrote, but those plays weren't performed regularly on the modern stage until the 50s, like post-World War II is really when people started paying attention to them. And so therefore, in terms of performance, she was his last heroine to kind of be discovered. And in the process of that research, and this is where I started discovering this cottage industry of single play adaptations about Margaret of Anjou from Shakespeare's first tetralogy, these four plays that we're talking about. And when I started my Emlet research, I knew about one of them, and I thought it was sort of an example of the trend I was talking about how Margaret has become so important. But then as I started writing my thesis, I was like, oh no, there's not one of them. This started the earliest at this point, and this is 10 years later from my thesis. I don't remember how many there were at the time I wrote my thesis, but now there have been at least 36 of these plays created. And the earliest one was in 1977.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
An entire Shakespeare's canon worth of Margaret plays written in like
exactly.
50 years.
And it's really fascinating because a lot of them will share, there are certain adaptive moves that this group will share and then this group will share. And it really feels like it's been snowballing, particularly since like the 2016 election. Like we see Margaret as this like political figure, and like we are obviously, particularly in America, thinking a lot about what it means to be a woman in politics coming out of the 2016 election. And so like they've just been, the number of these adaptations have just been amplifying, and the adapters and directors use very similar terms in their marketing material to talk about what they're doing, like how they're sort of creating a like a new feminist play by Shakespeare, like is the kind of terminology that gets thrown around a lot. And it's also really interesting because I would say up until a couple of years ago, the adapters were not aware that anyone else was doing this. And so a lot of times someone would think they were doing something that no one had ever done before. But I would say finally, like since like 2021, 2022, maybe a little earlier, probably back to like, I've got my little chart in front so I can remember, they probably even back to like maybe 2018 when I think the Jeannie O'Hare production happened at the Royal Exchange Theater, which I think was kind of the most widely like publicized on terms of a world stage. It's sort of the most well known. And I think at that point, people started realizing that more of these existed than they thought. But yeah, 36, as far as I know. And that includes five that were done last year.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so crazy. It's
yeah.
really cool, though. Like, it's exciting to hear that she's up on stage so much. of the ones you've seen, do you have favorites or like ones you want to see on stage more?
I do. I do. I've been really fortunate to have gotten to see a handful of them myself in person. And even beyond that, particularly when I was doing all my primary research, I got to interview a number of adapters, and a lot of people were very generous and would share their scripts with me. But I'll say, like, I have to shout out Michael Sexton's adaptation, which is called Margaret, A Tiger's Heart. And it had a workshop production at Red Bull Theater. And that one has sentimental value to me because that was the first one I knew about. And so that's the one I went into writing my thesis about, thinking, oh, this is saying something really interesting about Margaret. And then I found out there were all these other ones. But also, you know, I got to see the workshop production at Red Bull and then Michael, and talk to Michael about it. And he very nicely gave me permission to produce that script in grad school. And then I kept, even after I finished my graduate work, I kept publishing on Margaret and continuing this research. So most recently, I published a review in Shakespeare Bulletin about the Whitney White's By the Queen at Trinity Rep, which just happened last year. And I loved that production because of how like non-traditional or even like non-faithful it was, in fact. Because some of these adaptations tend to become very similar, because everyone's kind of dealing with the same struggles to make these adaptations like viable theatrical pieces. And what I loved about this piece is it was so different from any of the other adaptations, because Margaret's story was broken up by conversations among the like actor players about the dynamics of oppression. And it's like we were like listening in on their like rehearsal room debates. So it was like very much like we are modern performers talking about how we feel about the way Shakespeare wrote this. So I really hope that one has continued development in the future. And then I would say my overall favorite one is The Life and Death of Queen Margaret by Dan Morburn and Toby Vera Berkovici, and that was produced by Real Life Theater. And I found that one to be the most successful of the ones I've been able to see, because I found that many of the adaptations struggle to marshal the vast amount of material required to and to wrestle Margaret's story into an arc that can take place over a single evening, when there are you know 100 other characters involved in the foreplay arc. How do you get that down to one arc? And I think this version succeeded because it didn't try to make a new version of a history play. It was really more focused on there's just, I feel like you get stuck in a plot trap a lot of times when you're trying to make these adaptations work. And this production really seemed to be able to let go of that and focus on like emotional stakes and relationship. And then rather than trying to just be like a new version of a history play, they described it as an ensemble dance theater feminist retelling. So it was like, so they were willing to separate themselves from like the original way in which Shakespeare worked on this material. And I think you have to make a really engaging evening of theater, you have to be able to let go of the Shakespeare in some way that is authentic to what you're trying to create.
As they'd say on TikTok, you need a little spice.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. Charlene, before we wrap up, do you have any last thoughts you would like to add about Margaret?
I still will not let her go, because I am now, I've started writing a novel about her.
Oh, yay!
So, you know, maybe one day I'll finish it, but
hell yeah.
I was like coming out of the pandemic and then everything. Oh, I don't want to go too long for your audience, but I was producing History Cycle and it got canceled because of the pandemic, and it is being reimagined as audio productions, and those will be out later this year, of all 8 plays in broken into 24 episodes. But we stopped the project halfway through when COVID hit, so we staged the Henriade plays but then didn't get to these plays. And I was meant to play Margaret once we staged these four plays. And I just came out of that and I was like, I felt like I had so much I wanted to say about who I thought Margaret was that I like expected to be able to say through my acting. And I was sort of like, well, how else can I give the world like my take on Margaret? And I was like, oh, I'm gonna write a novel. So that's where we are now.
I love it. I hope it does get finished because I would read the shit out of that novel. Well, Charlene, thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
I'm so glad.
I'm so happy you're on the show. I've wanted you on for such a long time. I really appreciate it. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can follow Charlene and Bulls with the Bard at the handles either on your screen or in the description. And y'all, this is the final episode of the spring section of Broads and the Bard. I am getting married in April, so we are taking a little hiatus, but we will be back in either June or July to talk more about the wonderful women and non-binary folks who make Shakespeare what it is. Until then, bye y'all.
A thousand, thousand sighs to save, oh, lay me where sad true lover never find my grave to weep there.